From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This program's made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners like you. We're very thankful for you and for all who contribute to this show. For more information on how you can keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, Pesach, the Jewish observance of Passover, started Friday night at sundown and continues until April 11th. April 4th is the Buddhist Theravadin New Year, and the Hindu observance of Hanuman Jayanti. And on Sunday, while Orthodox Christians observe Palm Sunday, it's the Christian celebration of Easter. The week leading up to Easter Sunday is usually the busiest one of the year for Christian pastors. So we're taking the opportunity on this week's State of Belief to bring you highlights of some past shows that you may have missed and you should have heard, or you'll enjoy hearing again.
I'm State of Belief producer Ray Kirstein. As we pause for the Passover and Easter holidays, it's interesting to look back and see what we were talking about on the show at this time 8 years ago. In 2007, Welton was joined by Representative Charlie Rangel of New York. On the front burner was the newly formed Congressional Prayer Caucus, focused solely on a Christian expression of faith. As a bonus, you'll also hear the congressman's prediction for the outcome of the long-shot presidential bid of a man named Barack Obama.
Last week, a bipartisan group of legislators urged Americans to commit to praying for the nation for at least 5 minutes each week. The Congressional Prayer Caucus, headed by Congressman Randy Forbes of Virginia, wants to, quote, build a spiritual prayer wall around America that will not cease until God heals our land. The troubling thing about this national call to prayer is the exclusively Christian language being used to describe it. The Congressional Prayer Caucus says it stands for all faiths, yet the 38 members of the caucus are all Christian. One of them, Congressman Todd Akin of Missouri, said, "We deal with all kinds of problems in Congress, but I'm still like a little kid in Sunday school. Jesus is always the answer." Even if promoting its members' singular religious persuasion is not the intention of the caucus, it's hard for non-Christians to see this as anything but a supposition that Christianity is the proper and accepted religion, maybe what our founders called the established religion of the American government. Well, that's why it's encouraging to see other members of Congress discuss faith and religion by remaining sensitive to religious pluralism instead of using the language of traditional Christianity or Judaism or Islam, and you know the rest. Following the announcement by the Congressional Prayer Caucus, a resolution was submitted in the House of Representatives calling for a national week of reflection and tolerance. Although the resolution has the same underlying intentions as the national call to prayer, take a listen to how it's worded. Quote, "The week should encourage communities and institutions around the nation to engage in events and activities that are reflective, educational, celebratory, and healing as they relate to diversity among the people of the United States." See? Same intention, same goal, but much more inclusive. And the author of that resolution is our guest at this time, Congressman Charles Rangel. Congressman Rangel, it's great to have you here on State of Belief.
Good to be with you.
The Interfaith Alliance recently has affirmed with a lot of people your recent House resolution calling for a national week of reflection and tolerance. What prompted that on your part?
A whole lot of people believe, and I am one of them, that there are times in our lives where emotion blinds reason and we find ourselves hating people. As a kid, I was taught, I was 11 years old, to hate the Japanese, to hate the Italians, to hate the Germans. the hatred that existed against blacks in this country, where they were murdered and tortured and people were just indifference to it. I think taking a deep breath in life is helpful for the individual, and taking one for the country is just as important.
Well, listen, you have done so well in recognizing religious pluralism in the nation. I was at a Senate hearing not long ago, and every senator present introduced the other one as my Christian brother or my sister in Christ. Why is it so hard to get elected officials to recognize and honor religious pluralism in this nation?
I think, Reverend, that when you're born, your ideas that are in formation last you for life. And if you accept the fact that the majority of the people in this country are Christian, it's easy for people to block in their belief that the only way to get to heaven is through Jesus. All I know, Reverend, is that it's how you treat the lesser of my brothers and sisters. And I don't care what religion we're talking about. If that is going to be the guideline that we follow, it'll get us through.
I can't help but wonder when you say that how you feel when you listen to people like Pat Robertson and James Dobson, who obviously think Jesus was a Republican.
Well, I think a lot of them are in show business, and they get a script. And so I try not to be too harsh with these people. As a matter of fact, I have a tendency to feel sorry for them if they're sincere.
I'm talking with Congressman Charles Rangel, who has a new book of memoirs out entitled, And I Haven't Had a Bad Day Since. I want to pick up on that word since. That you use in the title, and I think you're referring to a life-threatening incident during the Korean War that obviously shaped your professional life. Would you tell us briefly about the event and how it did change you and maybe your faith?
Well, I was in for 2 years when we were alerted, the 2nd Infantry Division, that we're being shipped to Korea. We got there, fulfilled our mission. We fought from the southern tip and all the way to the northern border of North Korea, that's separated from China by the Yalu River. We were waiting there, tens of thousands of us, to go home when we found out that we were completely surrounded by the Chinese army. And for nights, they warned us that they were coming. And then on November 30th, 1950, they overrode our position. They took so many prisoners. They killed others. And I could hear the moaning and the screaming, and I got shot. I was thrown off an ammunition truck into a ditch. There was no question in my mind that my life was over. I was 20 years old. But I thought I'd take a chance, and I told sweet Jesus that if he just consider sparing my life, that he would have no problems with Charlie Rangel forever and ever and ever. And that happened, and I got out of there. I was able to take 43 men with me, got back to the States, and through a variety of events that's in the book, I was able to get a disabled veterans education, move forward to become an assistant United States attorney, a state legislator, a member of Congress, and chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. And throughout that path, I never had a bad day.
Congressman, I can't let go of a man of your insight without you telling us who's going to be the Democratic nominee for the presidency.
Well, you're closer to a higher authority than I am. I thought you could share that with me.
That's a good dodge. Do you think Obama is going to be there at the end?
I don't, but I really encouraged him to get into this race because I told him with his popularity and broad-based support, certainly he would hate himself for the rest of his life if he didn't test it. And being so young and so talented that even if he did lose, the opportunities for him to succeed in 4 or 8 years are just bountiful. And so I really don't believe that the popularity would sustain. A substance somehow is going to enter this race, and I think that Hillary Clinton will survive and come out as the winner.
Congressman Rangel, it's been a great pleasure talking with you on State of Belief.
Thank you, and remember me in your prayers.
That's Representative Charlie Rangel of New York, talking with Welton on the April 8, 2007 edition of State of Belief Radio. That same show featured a fascinating conversation with the Reverend Oliver Buzz Thomas, who had just published a book titled 10 Things Your Minister Wants to Tell You, but Can't Because He Needs the Job.
Buzz Thomas is a longtime friend of mine, and I'm actually proud to claim that on the air. Buzz, thanks for being with us on State of Belief.
Oh, thanks, Weldon. It is a real pleasure to be with you, and I appreciate so much the work that you're doing.
Okay, let's hear it. What's the biggest thing that you as a minister want to tell your parishioners?
Well, you know, as a minister that's also been in the parish ministry for many years like myself, that ministers have a challenging job, and most of them do a very good job and preach exactly what they feel led to preach and let the chips fall. But sometimes it's difficult for ministers to weigh in on subjects that their parishioners are deeply divided about. I think of the Episcopal Church right now, and it's split right down the middle over the ordination of Gene Robinson, a gay bishop. And I've talked to Episcopal priests who've said, you know, if I'm going to be a good pastor, I've got to be able to reach both sides of this controversy. And if I take sides in it, half my church doesn't want me at the hospital bed anymore. Mm-hmm. So, Welton, I've tried to take a more prophetic position on some of the issues that are difficult for pastors. And I think right now there's probably no more difficult issue than the issue of sexual orientation.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with you. What do you think, beyond a fear of losing the job, what's the other motivations for not addressing the issues that people are talking about?
Well, some of those motivations are very good motivations, Welton, like the priest that I was talking to just a couple of weeks ago, who was concerned that it would compromise his pastoral ministry with a large number of his congregants if he took sides on particularly the issue of ordination of gay and lesbian priests. And I understood that, and I respected it. You know, for those of us who went to seminary or divinity school, we had 3 years to chew on all the new information we were having to assimilate, some of which caused us to have a little bit of a faith crisis because, as you know, Welton, the church is full of people who've been taught that if one word of the Bible is false, then the whole thing goes down the tubes. Mm-hmm. And you find yourself in seminary, you've been taught that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were written by Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John almost as if they walked around with a notepad while Jesus was doing his ministry. Mm-hmm. And when you find out that they weren't, and they were written a generation later and all the rest of it, it throws a lot of folks into a tailspin. I've tried to help pastors here bring the seminary experience to their parishioners in a way that I hope is accessible to everybody. Well, there's been a lot of great theology written over the years, as you know, but it's in thick, inaccessible, dense tomes that gather dust on library shelves and at the airport travelers just not going to pick up. So I'm hoping that this will be an opportunity for us to raise some progressive Christian voices as an alternative to the kind of Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson sort of ultra-conservative stuff that is so dominant in the media today.
Tell the listeners what 4 or 5 of the issues are that you talk about, the, of the 10 things.
Well, for example, Welton, we just start right out by attacking this notion that's so common in Christian churches in the United States today that members need to choose between science and religion, that one can't accept the teachings of science and be a person of faith, particularly looking at the issue of intelligent design and creationism, and just challenging that and helping believers understand that Genesis chapter 1 was written in the form of a poem and was never intended to be taken seriously as a literal rendering of how the earth was created. Well, then there's a lot of stuff like this that I think people will be surprised and glad to hear. I think they'll also be pleased to hear that their tendencies to be more welcoming than perhaps they've been given permission to be. I think about my dad, Welton, who would have loved to have treated gay and lesbian people just like everybody else because he was a good human being, but he didn't feel like he had theological permission to do it in his Southern Baptist training. And then there's the chapter on the book of Revelation. Lord knows all the confusion that's in the country now. Part of it, I think, is a result of the Left Behind series and this popular notion that of a rapture and that Jesus is coming back to reign on earth. And I think people will be surprised to read that the book of Revelation was about what was going on in the first century in those seven churches of Asia Minor and not something that's about to happen next week.
Yeah, it strikes me that the authors of those Left Behind series know more about the end of time than the people who wrote the Bible.
Jesus said he did. That's right, Weldon. Jesus said no person knows the time, and they also have a theology that was rejected by the church centuries ago, as you know. I think people are going to be surprised when they find out that 666 isn't 666 in a lot of manuscripts. It's 616. And both of those, when you look at them, are the numerical equivalents of either Nerone Caesar, his full name, or his nickname as we know him today, Nero Caesar, which works out to 616. It's obvious once you find that out that John is not talking about some future leader of the United Nations or some other modern government, but rather he was talking about a dastardly Roman emperor whom they thought was reincarnated in Domitian. Nero Caesar. So I think there's a lot of stuff in here, Welton, that people would have gotten had they had the chance to go to divinity school or seminary, and I'm hopeful that it will help them find a way of reconnecting with spiritual things without having to go through all the hoops that sometimes churches make them.
I'm grateful that you address the subject of the way people in different faith traditions relate to each other, and particularly from a Christian point of view. Would you say just a word about that?
Well, then I so appreciate the Interfaith Alliance and what you folks are doing to try to have help us use faith to bring our nation together and not just tear it apart as many are doing today. And the chapter on other faiths, I think lots of Christians may be surprised to find that Jesus was not so exclusive in his claim. You know, Jesus does not suggest to his followers that every single person needs to do a particular religious thing. He doesn't say, well, everybody needs to accept me as their Lord and Savior in order to be right with God. Jesus talks to Jewish folk and he says, well, you know the law, you know what God requires, do this and you shall live. It's very difficult to nail Jesus down on one kind of pattern of evangelism. I think that the New Testament really pushes us to be less judgmental, more inclusive, and more willing to work alongside our brothers and sisters from different faith traditions. Welton, most of us are what we are because we were born into a family of that tradition, and I think we do well to respect the rights of other Americans to choose other pathways to God.
Are there any questions for which you're not sure what answer to give?
Well, there are. Well, in fact, there are many. I think the most important contribution of the book is to remind us that when it comes to matters of faith, we're all speculating. It requires a good, healthy dose of humility to remember that God is God, and we are creatures created by God, and we can never be cocksure about things of the Spirit. There's really no room in the household of God for this kind of cocksure arrogance that seems to be so pervasive in Christian theology today. So, yes, I hope one of the best contributions about the book is that a little humility is in order for all of us when we begin to talk about matters of the Spirit. And I hope that the result will be a kind of Christian view that's an alternative to the gay-bashing, gun-toting, flag-waving kind of sort of militant Christianity that we see so prevalent today.
Well, Oliver Buzz Thomas has been our guest. Buzz, you've done us a favor by what you've written, and thanks also for being with us on State of Belief.
God bless you, Welton, and thanks so much for your great work.
As we mark both Passover and Easter, let's get Welton Gaddy's thoughts on the intersection of those holidays as originally broadcast on April 8, 2007.
During this past week, Jews and Christians all over the world have been gathering for reflections fed by memory, expressions of concern motivated by recognition of reality, and celebration evoked by hope. Today, Christians celebrate Easter. Peering into their pasts and future, Jews and Christians have wept and laughed, prayed and committed themselves to world-changing actions. In its essence, all of this is about liberation. Tears for the oppressed and laughter spawned by the very thought of freedom. Clearly discernible within the rituals and the liturgies of these special days is a vision of the positive and healing role that religion can play in a world shattered by controversy, conflict, and violence, and weakened by divisions fostered by prejudice and bigotry. Sadly, however, even the approach to these significant days in Judaism and Christianity has been tainted by the ugly face of religious extremism that seems to take great pride in religion acting as a negative and divisive force in society. Drawing from distorted stereotypes, Pat Robertson has once again demonized Islam as a religion to be thwarted and claiming for himself ability usually assigned only to deity. James Dobson has declared who is and who is not worthy to be called a Christian. Tell me, please, how does such rhetoric, based more on political preferences than religious principles, serve anyone well? On Tuesday of this past week, I participated in the Passover meal with the family of Ann and Rabbi Jack Moline and their wonderful family. And then on Thursday evening, I gave leadership to a Maundy Thursday communion service with my congregation in Monroe, Louisiana. Both experiences prompted my engagement with the present as well as with the past, and demanded that if I ate the meals responsibly, I would recommit myself to living with respect for religious differences, expressing appreciation for the values that reside in different religious traditions, and dedicating time and actions to enabling the world to see and be changed by positive efforts to effect healing and point to hope for cooperation. I know many of you may not involve yourselves in either of these traditions or perhaps in any religious movement at all. But I know you and I and scores of others share a common goal. With respect for those who gather around different ritual tables, and with concern for our communities splintered by deep divisions inflicted by biased religions and partisan politics, each of us can take advantage of the special emphases of this past week and of today's celebration of freedom called Easter, to do our part in advancing liberation for all people, a cause that is good for everybody except tyrants.
I'm State of Belief producer Ray Kirstein. On April 11, 2009, we first brought you the fascinating story of the Tri-Faith Initiative in Omaha, Nebraska. Here's that conversation once again.
The Nebraska-based Interfaith Coalition is engaging in what could be the first project of its kind in this nation. They plan to build a joint campus that will house a Reformed synagogue, an Episcopalian church, and a mosque, three houses of worship from the three major world religions, all in one space. Joining me now to talk about the project is the executive director of the Tri-Faith Initiative, Nancy Kirk. How did this project with the Interfaith Campus come about?
It started when Temple Israel, which has been in Omaha for well over 100 years, began looking for a new site. They have so outgrown the current temple, which was built for 350 families, and they're now at almost 800 families. So they're bursting at the seams, and they have a long tradition of interfaith work. And they had been in discussions, very informal discussions, with the Islamic Center of Omaha, and had heard that that group was also forming a new corporation, the American Institute for Islamic Studies and Culture, with the goal of building a new mosque in West Omaha. And they decided they should get together. You know, it's kind of a coincidence that they're both looking to build new spaces at once. And they decided they should have a talk. And they agreed to meet at one of the Omaha Public Libraries. And the Jewish delegation came in from one side of the library, and the Muslim delegation came in from the other side of the library, meeting in the middle and finding that they had all brought baked goods from home, that the tradition of hospitality and breaking bread together, that is the very foundation of the Abrahamic faith. And they sat down together and shared the homemade goodies and talked about their dreams for their new spaces, and realized that there was a potential for a great partnership here, but if they were going to celebrate the convergence of the Abrahamic faith, they really needed to engage the third great Abrahamic faith, which is, of course, Christianity. So they went out to look for a Christian partner for this effort and initially approached the Roman Catholic Archdiocese in Omaha, but the Archdiocese had some other priorities. And then they approached the Episcopal Diocese of Nebraska, which happened to also be looking for land to build a new church in the same general location, which is the one area of the city that does not currently have an Episcopal church. Everyone, you know, just took this as a real sign that there was some great potential here for sharing not just land together, but our lives together on one campus.
Did you think you'd be able to pull this off?
Yes, with a great deal of faith. I think there was a real sense on the part of all the participants that God was really at work in this, and that there's no reason not to expect miracles. And everything kept working. It was beyond what many interfaith efforts have been, which have been great around the country, that focus on dialogue and getting to know each other better and having social things. What made this group unique was one of the very first things they talked about were their fears. And they put them right out on the table at the beginning because they figured if they couldn't talk honestly with each other about their fears of joining together and working on a campus, that it was never going to happen and would never work. And it turned out the greatest fear that all three groups had was of evangelism, that one group would try to get members of another group to cross the line. And that this was true for all three of the faith groups. And so they drafted a memo of understanding and said, on this campus, there will be no proselytizing.
What kind of real challenges have you faced? Any negative responses? And what do you anticipate as challenges in the future?
When the latest eruption of conflict in Gaza right before the first of the year happened, I went into the January board meeting not knowing if we would have an organization at the end of the meeting. But what this group has done consistently is just as they did with the first discussion about what they feared most in doing a joint campus, is that they lay their feelings and their fears out on the table for everyone to look at and everyone to discuss. And the president of the Muslim Institute came into that board meeting and said, my community is in great pain. And that allowed for a level of discussion about Gaza. And you have to understand, one of our board members is a Palestinian whose family's in Gaza, a native Palestinian, now an American citizen. And another board member is the temple rabbi, who is a native Israeli, now an American citizen. And those two men have been great friends for 18 years. But with the conflict in Gaza, everyone felt somewhat threatened, but even more committed to dialogue, and people started asking us, how can you try to do this tri-faith project in the midst of all this that's going on? And our board chairman, Bob Freeman, I thought had the perfect response. He said, the question is not how can we do it. The question is, how can we not?
As an update, construction of the Tri-Faith Center is anticipated to begin in early 2016, with the campus completed in 2017. You can learn more at trifaith.org. Up next on this Best of State of Belief program, a few minutes from a 2010 interview with Don Kepler, founding director of Building Jewish Bridges on Holidays and Interfaith Families.
What is it like for interfaith Jewish Christian families this time of the year? What are the challenges that you see?
Well, the challenge that is always number one for families year-round and then just comes to a point at a holiday time like this is, what will we do about the children? How are we going to raise the kids? What identity do we want them to have? And then how will we make that happen at our home? Because if one person's a Jew and one person is a Christian, neither of them have the role-modeled experience of how you would do that.
My guess is that one of the big concerns would be not to seem to prioritize one faith over the other, of one parent saying, well, my faith's more important than yours. Is that a common concern?
Well, I think that it's a common misconception that most families are trying to do both, because that is actually the hardest thing to do. And what I find with couples is that commonly neither parent particularly cares about religion, or one parent is more attached to religion and the other parent is more secular. The minority is when a deeply devout Jew and a deeply devout Christian get together, because those two positions in life kind of naturally take you away from each other. So if you're a really observant Jew, it's unlikely that you're going to be around a devout Christian. So it's the minority that really are trying to do both in a home, and that is the most challenging, because if you both are attached to your religion, you often end up with the child, you're trying to be fair to your partner, and so you're doing sort of the King Solomon, will we cut the child in half? How will we share this child equally? And that, I think, is the most painful.
So what is the most common piece of advice that you give parents during this time of year?
My most common piece of advice year-round is figure out what it is your goal is. What is it you really want? And you have to start out by knowing, who am I? Because I always say to a couple, your child has to know both of you. You are their parents. You can't, even if one faith is subordinate or both faiths are, well, they're cultural, I'm not really religious, your child has to know, where did I come from? So once you've decided, who am I, who is my partner, what are we going to tell our child they are? And there's a difference between knowledge and being. You know one thing, you be something else. You obviously know about Christianity, Hinduism, Islam, but you are a Christian, I am a Jew. What will your child be? And then working sort of backwards from that, how will you raise your child to be who you want them to be and to know about their parent, their other parents' religious background or cultural background, and have that be a comfortable part of their identity, because they will, in fact, encompass both people in themselves.
Yeah. Great point. When do you talk to your children about this?
I think you start from the beginning and you do it in age-appropriate ways. And the challenge for adults is that we have full capacity for gray thinking. And we look at our children and they're marvelous and wonderful and insightful and magical and awesome. And we think that they're understanding on our level, and they're not. So it's important to look at what's developmentally appropriate for children. And I think it's always appropriate to go to your clergy and say, I'm thinking about teaching little Julie about this. When would be a good time? Mm-hmm. So, for example, for Jewish parents, there's always the challenge of, when do you teach about the Holocaust? This is a big, scary concept. Right. I think that the crucifixion of Jesus is a pretty scary concept. So I'm assuming a minister would help you with how do you explain this to a child in such a way that they don't feel frightened by what they're learning, mm-hmm. and they're taking it in a little at a time and ultimately understanding, I'll say God willing, that's where I'm coming from, as an adult, they would understand the complexities of a concept like crucifixion and resurrection, and they would understand the complexities that are existent in the Passover story, which can be very simplified for a child, but is very complex for an adult.
Don Kepler is the founding director of Building Jewish Bridges. Don, thanks for being with us on State of Belief.
Thank you very much.
Not all of the voices we've brought you on State of Belief are still with us. The Reverend Dr. Forrest Church appeared regularly on State of Belief Radio until his untimely death in 2009. On March 22, 2008, Dr. Church was with us to discuss his latest book, and the conversation is as timely today as it was 7 years ago.
Reverend Forrest Church is a minister of All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Manhattan. He's the author of the new book, So Help Me God, The Founding Fathers and the First Great Battle Over Church and State. Forrest Church also comes from a distinguished line of prominent politicians. His grandfather was a governor and his father was Frank Church, a six-term Democratic senator from Idaho. Forrest, welcome to State of Belief.
I'm delighted to be with you. I'm always delighted to be with you.
You have said that the group that says America was founded as a Christian nation and the group that says we have an explicitly secular foundation are both half right.
Both 100% half right. That's
now
exactly
explain
right.
that.
Well, the same division we have today existed right at the founding. There are two sources that combine to create the American experiment. One is it comes out of New England. It's the notion of a Christian commonwealth or a commonwealth of God with a strong moral foundation. And the other comes out of the Enlightenment, particularly Enlightenment France, the notion of sacred liberty. So divine order and sacred liberty came right up against one another on this question of church-state separation.
So much of this thought is embodied, or it seems to me, is embraced by the phrase which you use and others do so regularly, so help me God. Tell us about that phrase.
Well, that goes into and then comes out of inaugural lore with Washington. It's not certain that he actually said it. I believe he did. There was an argument going on at the time as to whether or not senators and congressmen would swear, so help me God. That was the first bill indicated they would. Finally, they just swore to uphold the Constitution. But the first inaugural was set up by the church party, by an Episcopalian, actually, Richard Henry Lee of Virginia. And there was a worship service identified with the inaugural. I expect that Washington said, so help me God. I know that Jefferson asked the Supreme Court Justice John Marshall explicitly whether or not he had to say anything else other than the congressional oath. Marshall said he did not. From that point on until late in the 19th century when inaugurations were modeled after the Washington model, there was no so help me God in the oath of office that the president swore.
And when we look at the different perspectives on religion and the presidency, that comes out for most people out of a concern for the relationship between religious institutions and political institutions. The First Amendment obviously has the religious liberty clauses in it. The phrase separation of church and state has become kind of a bad phrase in some people's minds. Where did that come from?
Well,
what's the development?
What's so interesting, the point I make in So Help Me God, to tracing the story of the first American culture war, it's interesting that the religious left of the time, the people who wanted to have absolute separation of church and state, very, very severe, the leaders of that movement were the Baptists. It was the Baptists, the Methodists who were more passive. All of the religious outsiders, the Catholics, the Jews, all wanted church-state separation. Why? Because they knew from past experience that whenever God had a seat in government, it wasn't going to be their God. The religious right back then were the Unitarians, the Congregationalists, the Episcopalians. Why? Because they were the elites. They peopled the governments of the states that had established religions, and it was their churches that benefited from the church-state collusion. So what that – and that actually continues, that idea of religious outsiders being supportive of church-state separation or independent spheres, if you'd prefer to put it that way, the religious insiders not being as sensitive to the dangers of this kind of collaboration. And it took throughout the entire first 30 years of our history finally to sort this out. It wasn't until after the War of 1812 that church and state were actually separate, and they remained quite separate from that point on until the Civil War.
Now, I know that some of our listeners are still in the process of adjusting their radios because you said that the Baptists were
the hard,
left,
the hard left,
and the Unitarians were the right.
That's exactly right.
Now, how did that flip-flop?
Well, it flip-flopped because today the Baptists are, to a degree, along with the religious right, I'll call them, as long as the Republicans are in power anyway, they are the religious insiders. They don't. They know that, that government will have their ear. And so they don't. They're not as sensitive to the issue as they were when they were being persecuted, when they had to pay taxes for someone else's churches. But if they go back, the Baptists go back to their history, they will find it. And in So Help Me God, the heroes of the book are really the Baptist pastors. I mean, they join with Jefferson and Madison, first of all, to disestablish religion in the state religion of Virginia, and then to create a freedom of conscience clause in the Constitution, the First Amendment. It is, by the way, Welton, it's the Baptist pastors of Orange and Culpeper County, Virginia, who forced Madison to do what he didn't want to do, and that is to champion a Bill of Rights and to write a First Amendment, because he was running for Congress in Virginia, and they'd always been allies throughout their many struggles, but Madison was not in favor of amendments. He did not think there should be a Bill of Rights. And it was the Baptist pressure lobbies in Virginia that forced him to commit, should he be elected to Congress, that he would put at the top of his agenda a Bill of Rights and a First Amendment, Freedom of Conscience Clause. And so they get credit, the Baptists get credit more than any other group for the establishment of the First Amendment, which today sometimes they complain about.
It was a Baptist pastor, as I recall, named James Leland.
John Leland, right.
John Leland,
right.
That knew how to do political lobbying with Madison to see that he got
It was Leland and a number of others who lived in Orange County at the time. Leland pops up everywhere. He's like Zelig in this story. He also participated in disestablishment of religion in Connecticut and in Massachusetts.
Recently, I saw numbers, I think it was from the First Amendment Center, from polling that they had done in which 60%+ of the American people that responded said they considered this a Christian nation. We had Senator McCain, a senior senator,
yes,
recently say that the Constitution established a Christian nation. Can you believe that?
It's important. Everyone seems fascinated by the history of our founding, and I think that's wonderful. But it's important that we go back to that history and read it straight. And I think that's important for people on the right as well as those on the left. For instance, people need to recognize, who are very opposed to any kind of religion in politics, that it was the God Party, if you were, the established church party, that forced the issue of abolition. If the church-state separatists, the Jeffersonians, the sacred libertarians had had their way, the government would never have gotten involved in emancipation because there was no legislating of morality. But to go back to our founding and say that we were founded as a Christian nation is to actually completely subvert the genius of the founders, who do not introduce religion into the Constitution. And every time, Welton, that there's been an attempt to put God or Christ into the Constitution, that attempt has been very easily knocked down. Are we a religious country? And in fact, do we even have a religious government? To a degree, yes. Particularly since the Civil War, when In God We Trust went on the coinage and the idea of a national Thanksgiving was established. But the religiosity of the nation goes back always. The reference is the Declaration of Independence. So part of our being a religious nation is that we defend the rights of church-state separation and religious freedom. That is part of our American religiosity, So to say that we're not at all religious is wrong, and to say that we're Christian is wrong. In fact, we're religious in a kind of Jeffersonian Declaration of Independence way.
Are we going to just keep on talking about the Republican Party as the party of God, the religious party, and the Democratic Party, otherwise?
It's changing. I thought, when I started writing this book, when I started writing So Help Me God, I thought that we were in danger of creating a religious party and a secular party in this country. I divide this. It would be an unum party and a pluribus party, if you think about e pluribus unum, one nation under God versus liberty for all. In my opinion, whichever one of those parties won, the nation would lose. What I see happening today is that what always happens, once the pendulum flows too far in the unum direction or in the pluribus direction, there's a natural kind of corrective. So I think that danger point of our having a unum party and a pluribus party, a religious party and a secular party, is passing. And it's a good thing, because both of our parties need to be aware, on the one hand, of the importance of a moral foundation for American governance, and on the other hand, in the importance of the Liberty Clause and absolute freedom of conscience and freedom of belief.
Reverend Forrest Church is a minister at All Souls Church in Manhattan. We've been discussing, among other things, his most recent book, So Help Me God, The Founding Fathers and the First Great Battle Over Church and State. It's always a pleasure to talk with you, Forrest, and what a thrill it is to talk with you with our audience on State of Belief. Thanks for being here.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. That was fun, I must say, listening to programs that we did in the past that are just as relevant today. The ongoing financial support of State of Belief listeners is essential for keeping this show on the air. I want to thank you if you've made a financial donation to us this week. If you find value in what we're doing, I urge you to join our other generous supporters today. Please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can sign up for our free weekly podcast. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/stateofbelief. And we hope you share the stories you hear on State of Belief with your friends and neighbors. They are compelling stories, and your friends and neighbors need to be involved in this conversation. We're also at twitter.com/stateofbelief. This is not a time that we can take anything for granted. It's not time for people like us to remain silent. If you find value in what you hear, please spread the word about State of Belief. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. Yes, he was. He was. Yes, he was.